A big warm welcome wherever you're listening to this podcast, Misadventures in Music, Series 2, Episode 2, with me, Mick Ord.
And me, Ian Prowse.
And there's a big soul theme to this month's Misadventures in Music, which is great, because we haven't done much soul before, have we really, Ian? Not recently, anyway. No. About 2 months ago, I watched a BBC Four documentary, The Motown Invasion. It's still on YouTube and it's still on BBC iPlayer and it's a cracking programme. It's called When Motown Came to Britain. It featured Stevie Wonder, The Supremes, The Temptations and all that. And this is from the early 60s. Also included in that programme was our guest today, an expat Scouser who's now living in that there London, Frank Collins. Now, Frank has played and sung with a number of bands over the years, and he's going to tell us his story. And he also met some of the people from the Motown Invasion. Again, more on that a little bit later. Frank has been in his own bands. He's played with Bob Dylan, Brian Ferry, and many, many more. Welcome to Misadventures in Music. Great to see you and hear you, hopefully.
Hi, Mick. Yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're good, thank you. And now, you were born in Kirkdale.
Yeah.
Is right, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you moved to Kirby.
Yes.
And then in the early 60s, you set up a soul band, the Excels.
Yeah.
And I searched all over the internet and I couldn't find any music from the Excels, which is a real shame. Have you not got any?
No. Back then in Liverpool, there's no recording studios except like little backstreet places, you know? So unfortunately, we did actually record at the Cavern Studios and we were going to do a scene at 6:30, which was a programme on Granada TV back then in the 60s. We don't know what happened to those tapes. But they would be the only sort of legitimate recordings that we did. Other recordings that we did in some backstreet house, someone's house with little bits of curtain hanging up for soundproofing, you know, and a little Grundig tape recorder. They were the ones that we sent to the guy who became our manager, Tony Hall, which were just on, like, I can't remember whether it was reel-to-reel or cassette. I can't actually remember. Probably a reel-to-reel thing. And those recordings were lost as well. So they were the only ones of the Excels that we actually recorded, but we can't find them anymore. So it's a shame.
And you were never really into sort of rock and roll and Merseybeat, was it? Soul was your love, is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, Motown was the thing for me. There's lots of, you know, the Merseybeat sound, the rock bands and whatever at the Cavern. The Beatles had started and the whole Merseybeat thing was, you know, doing well. Just decided to form a vocal group doing Motown covers, which we did around the sort of local clubs, working men's clubs and whatever in Liverpool. And we ended up doing Cavern gigs, gigs at the Cavern. And we were considered like a sophisticated band because we were all very slick, suits and ties and all that. Quite different to the usual rock bands that would play at the Cavern. Consequently, we became like a sort of group's group and all the other groups used to come down to see us because we were doing quite sophisticated stuff. Lead voice, three-part harmonies, all the routines, like, you know, imitating the Motown acts. Yeah, so that was our first love. So that was my passion, just Motown music. I wasn't really interested in the Mersey sound, but in retrospect, I appreciate it more now for what it was.
What was the standing of Motown music back then? Because, you know, later on in the 70s and 80s, 90s, I never, ever went to a family do, whether it be a wedding, a christening or anything, where the music, the folk music of the working classes was Motown. And to this day, if I hear Jimmy Mac, if it takes me by surprise somewhere, or any classic Motown song, I can be reduced to tears on the spot.
Really?
So ingrained in our culture, you know. But in the early 60s, when you're first getting into it, I'm guessing that it wasn't so widespread and so well.
No, it was. I would hear the Motown stuff maybe probably on Radio Luxembourg, maybe on some pirate stations at the time.
Kind of left field, was it? It was.
Yeah. It was sort of, I guess you could say, underground at the time. Wow. But was always very popular in Liverpool. Yeah. And my theory is that Liverpool was quite similar to Detroit, where Motown came from.
Rough, you mean?
Exactly, yeah. Rough working class.
Yeah.
Making motor cars, you know, Motown was a motor city. Liverpool with Fords and whoever. And I just think that brand of soul, pop soul, resonated with Liverpool people.
There's an undercurrent of struggle in all Motown.
Yeah. I think you felt the passion of being, you know, from a working class city or whatever, or background. It's that intangible thing that you just feel it. You just related to the whole passion and delivery and sound of Motown.
It's so joyous, Motown music, but
fabulous.
Read a lot of the lyrics, and they're really, you know, like I mentioned Jimmy Mac.
Yeah.
Basically, I don't know if there's a Vietnam War context going on, but she's basically saying, if you don't come back soon, this other fella's, I'm finding it difficult to resist his.
Yeah.
And you're going to.
When are you coming back?
Yeah. And a lot of the lyrics are like that. A lot of the lyrics are really downbeat, married to the most amazingly soulful, joyous melodies.
What strikes me with Motown, it's not obvious choruses. Sometimes it could just be a line that is the hook of the whole song.
Yeah.
It quite a different structure, and it still sounds contemporary to me.
Yeah,
it still sounds sophisticated. It's not your sort of verse, bridge, chorus, here we go. I don't know. It's just like, I just love it. I'm rambling on, but I just love it.
There's a kind of sense as well, and I mean, you know, Liverpool has a great tradition of being a party town. For various historical reasons, mainly to do with the fact that people didn't know when they were going to be working, because if it was bad weather, there's no ships in, nobody gets paid. If there was inclement weather for a couple of weeks, everybody's hanging around with no money or anything. When the ships did come in, bit of money, let's have a party immediately.
Yeah. Scousers are always up for a good time, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of, in Motown music, that's baked in, isn't it? As soon as you hear it has joy and sorrow in all aspects of it.
Yeah, well, as soon as you hear something like Get Ready by the Temps, Maybe I Need Your Loving, I Can't Help Myself.
Oh, come on.
They still excite the hell out of me. They really do. Yeah. But it's just like, if I'm feeling in a blue mood, if I'm feeling a bit down, I'll just play some Motown.
Yeah.
And the likes of like Dancing in the Street, it's got to be the best Motown production.
I find it so emotional when I hear it. I don't know what it is.
You're a big softie, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, the first song we're going to play, Frank, the first one that you asked me to play was one that I know the Beatles recorded. Everyone will know the song. They might know the singer. I'm going to play that now anyway. Okay.
Okay. Do I shut up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
when you first heard that, Frank, what was your reaction, or what was the, you know, was it a massive hit in this country, or was it just a radio hit, or what?
I think it was probably a radio hit. I can't remember whether it charted or not. I think I was maybe still at school or just on the verge of, you know, leaving. But when I heard it, I thought, what's this? You know, I hadn't heard anything like it. I think you can hear, like, it's a very sort of gospel influence type of thing with all the background chanting. And that's what caught my ear originally. Just like, that's what I want. I loved all that stuff, you know. I just loved it.
I mean, it's not rock and roll, but it's rocking, isn't it?
It just sounds so organic.
Yeah.
In the days when they just used to all get in the studio together and record, no overdubbing back in those days, four tracks and whatever it was. Yeah, just a great record.
It's a collision of a few things, isn't it? The song, and it's I don't. It sounds like the birth of rock and roll to me. That sort
Is
of
it really?
You know, it all comes back to black music, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And to me, I would class it more as funk.
Yeah.
Like, just with the sort of the driving beat that it's got, his soulful voice, and just the fact that it's typical of the Americans just to say, I want money. Because in England, we're all too conservative to admit that.
Yeah, it's got a really raw message, hasn't it?
Yeah,
that must have been like, quite exciting if you were a teenager at the time.
Unabashed, you know, I want money, that's what I want. Quite a mercenary theme, but still. I mean, that was I didn't know it was Motown at the time. I wasn't aware of the Motown label. I just knew it was a great record.
And did you sing it? Did the XL sing that?
No, we never did that one, no. We sort of stuck more to the girly group. Things like the Supremes, Martin and the Mandelas, Marvin Gaye, Tommy Terrell. Yeah, so I guess maybe the sort of more commercial side of Motown, yeah.
Well, you certainly did The Ronettes, didn't you? And that's our next track, isn't it?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, as I say, it was sort of, you know, it didn't have to be Motown. It could be just songs that we liked that we did. Yeah, Be My Baby, yeah.
Packs a punch, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, the Spectre sound was something else, wasn't it?
He was something else.
He was something else. Did you see that programme on telly? Oh,
Jesus.
I know, yeah. It was amazing, wasn't it?
let's not get sidetracked by
it. What money and power does to people.
Yeah.
But exactly. No, I mean, he made some great records, some just big, big productions, fantastic.
And so you did that version. What was your version? Was it a cappella? Was it?
No, it was just me with a guitar and a tiny little lamp. And we used to go to the social clubs in Kirby, in Speke, around Liverpool. So just guitar, and then we'd use, they'd always have like a resident band there. So we just used to use the drummer from the resident band, who were always terrible, but at least it gave us a bit of a backbeat. So it was me on guitar, my twin sister on the lead vocals, me on background vocals, and Paddy McHugh and Carol Carter of the XLs, on vocal backing. Yeah, that was our sound on stage, just the guitar and drum.
At which point, having covered all of these fantastic songs and basically kind of done your education, I suppose.
Yeah.
Great music is made, constructed, and sang and everything. At which point did you think to yourself, I might have a crack at writing some of my own here? When did that come, later or much later or around this time?
Yeah, I would say sort of towards the end of the XLs, before we moved to London, then became a rival. Yeah, I had a little bash at writing a few songs. I can't even remember the titles, to be quite honest. But yeah, it was in me, I think, just to compose and write songs. So yeah, in our stage shows, we never did any of my songs. They probably weren't good enough. They're probably a load of shit, to be quite honest.
When the Motown Artists all came to the UK, Frank, which is what first alerted me to your contribution on that BBC4 documentary, can you just talk us through when you heard they were coming and then you went to see them? Because it must have been, if Motown was an underground taste, that to have them come over must have been like your dream come true, really.
Oh, yeah. I think it was all generated, as it's explained in that programme you've referred to, by this guy called Dave Godin. And he started a thing called the Tamla Motown Appreciation Society. And he was very instrumental in bringing the Motown Review to England. And he was such a passionate fan. He said, oh, you've got to come over, whatever.
So and this is what, 1964, is it?
Yeah, round about then, yeah. I was only two. Anyway, let's not go there. I can't remember how I heard about it, but obviously I did. Me and the rest of the XLs went down to the Liverpool Empire there to see the show. And even then, it was like only a half-capacity audience. It wasn't sold out, even though Motown was that popular in Liverpool. But it was just brilliant. Stevie Wonder, The Supremes, I think Martha was on it as well. I can't remember whether the Four Tops were there.
You know, what was Stevie Wonder like?
Amazing, just like a loose cannon on stage. Yeah, playing his harmonica, playing the drums, singing, you know.
Yeah.
He was only 15 then.
Oh, Jesus. Imagine that.
It was brilliant. I mean, to us, like, we were just a gog, because there was our heroes in front of us, just sounding great and whatever. And, you know, there's nothing to me on the British scene to compare with that.
No.
You know, just all the dance steps and everything, the presentation. It was just so fresh and new. It was just brilliant.
Real deal.
Oh, yeah.
And you tried to meet Stevie afterwards, didn't you? Tell us that story. I don't think Ian's heard this one.
We did meet Stevie. We didn't try to. We did.
Go away.
After the show, we sort of went into the dressing area to the stage door, waiting and waiting. But they'd obviously made their exit already. So in the end, we got fed up. So we thought we'd just go home, get the bus. So we're walking down Lime Street. And there used to be a restaurant called the Eurasia, which was opposite a cinema that used to be called The Futurist.
Yeah.
Which is a real, you know, original Art Deco building. And I don't even know what it is now.
They've knocked it down.
They knocked it down.
Have they knocked it down now?
I actually got Elvis Costello into the... just before they knocked it down, I got him entry.
And when did they knock it down?
About 5 years ago. And I got... Elvis's dad used to play there in The Futurist. So we got him into the dilapidated cinema so we could have a look around before they knocked it down.
But what a shame.
It's just a total shame. And what's there now, it's just a nothing building.
Anyway, it was opposite that the Futurist cinema. And the restaurant had a glass door. We were walking, you know, me, Paddy and Carol and my twin sister, just walking down Lime Street to get our bus. And then we just happened to look into the restaurant. And sitting in there at a table was Stevie Wonder, his tutor, a guy called Ted Hull, and his musical director, a guy called Clarence Paul. We, in our set, we used to do a song called I Wonder, which was by the Crystals.
Yeah,
I sang a bit of that on the Motown show, actually, on the telly. So because of the word wonder, we thought we'll sing I Wonder because of Stevie Wonder. So we're singing it full three-part harmony. And then Ted Hull, his tutor, comes outside and stood waiting for us to finish, you know.
So you're on the pavement singing this?
Yeah, just on the pavement in Lime Street.
As it, by way of entertaining Stevie Wonder with his name.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder who he'll be. One of them, you know.
Yeah.
And he came out and he started adding his own words. And he was saying, sign them up and all this.
Brilliant. So
we were thrilled, obviously.
Yeah.
And we'd only be about 18 or 19 at the time. Anyway, from that, they were doing a show in Chester. So Ted Hull, Stevie's tutor, invited us to the show in Chester. So I thought, great. So we went over there when the show was on and ended up in Stevie Wonder's hotel room with Ted Hull and his manager, Clarence Paul. And we sang three songs. We kind of auditioned, you know. And Stevie loved us. He kept saying, you got to sign them up, you got to sign them up. And Ted Hull loved us, but Clarence Paul just seemed totally disinterested. So we did all that, and then that finished, and then they said, well, we're going to go down to eat now. So we said, well, can we come and join you? But they said, well, not really, it's not protocol. But we went down, and in the restaurant, we could see the Supremes, Smokey Robinson, all that, waiting for dinner, you know. But we weren't allowed in, unfortunately. So we just, you know, had to say thank you very much and goodbye. And basically, that was the last we heard of it. But now I can claim I've sung with Stevie Wonder. Brilliant.
You didn't have your dinner with Smokey Robinson. So.
No, unfortunately. We were ready to dash in, you know, being typical Liverpool kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So, no, you can't, you know. It was their downtime. And having been in the business now myself, I realise what that's about. Yeah. After you've done your show, you know, you don't want to be bombarded all the time with people slobbering over you, you know.
That's a lovely tale. I mean, I saw him live in Manchester about 10 to 15 years ago, and I think it was the best concert I've ever seen.
He
could hit every note.
I know.
And there must have been like 15, 20,000 people there. And the way he was talking to the audience, I guess for obvious reasons, because he can't see.
Yeah.
It was as if he was in Halewood Labour Club. Wow. He was just saying, are you all right? Oh, yeah. It was just wonderful. It was just intimate.
He's so down to earth, Stevie. And, you know, they use the word genius, which is quite misplaced a lot of the time. But Stevie Wonder is a musical genius.
He's underrated as well.
Do you think so?
Yeah, no, I don't think he gets the kudos that he deserves.
Maybe not.
It gets handed out to many, many other artists, you know. Yeah. But Stevie Wonder's underrated. It's like James Brown is underrated.
Oh, God, James Brown. Godfather of funk, yeah.
Stevie's right up there with the very, very, very best of them.
Yeah, well, there's no one like him, is there? He's unique.
No. You listen to songs in the Key of Life, and he's playing every fucking instrument on the record, for God's sake.
Yeah, what a bitch.
Yeah, bastard.
on he goes. And it still amazes me. I haven't heard him recently, but his range is something else. Yeah. His vocal range, yeah. Apart from his musical range and his writing ability. And some of his songs are just so absolutely beautiful. His ballads.
We're going to move on to Arrival now, because I remember seeing you on Top of the Pops in 1969 or so. That was way before Ian's time. So I'm going to
get your age away.
We ate him now. All right, Frank. I'm going to play Arrival, and then you talk us through how Arrival happened and what.
Okay, you're going to play it now.
I certainly am. Yes,
I've got to shut up then. I Will Survive, which was our follow-up.
Okay, so you were in that band, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was me, Diane Birch. I was getting a bit emotional listening to that because we lost Diane a couple of years ago. Oh. She's the lead singer. So it's just got me a bit emotional, to be quite honest.
And that was a massive hit in the UK, wasn't it, Frank?
It got to number five, I think. So
sounds like a hit, doesn't it?
I mean, it got great radio play at the time. It was on all the major stations and whatever. And it wasn't really doing anything till we did that Top of the Pops, which was the New Year's Day, 1970. And after that, it just zoomed up the charts. But yeah, got to about number five.
So you wrote a rival's other single hit, didn't you? I Will Survive, which is not the Glory Again, the song.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Back in 1970 as well. It was our follow-up to Friends. And it got to about number 14, I think, in the charts.
And you wanted to dedicate it to Ukraine, yeah?
Yeah, I just think, whether they have an anthem, it's just because of, obviously, the situation with Ukraine and the war. I just think that the lyrics could lend themselves to that situation, really. I Will Survive. Yeah, I'd just like to dedicate it to the Ukrainians who are all suffering and go through this horrible war.
Crush my spirit of life, drain my emotions, break my heart up, sink it in an ocean. Now my hopes are still alive, but through all this, I will survive.
Set the winds of revenge on me, revenge won't be sweet on me. Lock me in bolts and chains.
Can you just talk us through then after that big hit, what was your career like? Because you played the Isle of Wight, didn't you?
We did. Yeah, we flew in by helicopter.
Go on.
I know. Only way to travel, darling. We flew in, did our set, and then flew back out that night because we had a gig. I can't even remember where it was, but we had a gig back in London. So we were only there to do our set. But I think on that same day, people like Joni Mitchell were on, and, you know, like the popular sort of rock groups of the day. I can't even remember who they were, to be quite honest.
Yeah. Well, I read an article by Bill Harry, who edited Merseybeat, didn't he, in the early...
Yeah, I remember Bill, yeah.
And he's written this article, and he said in this article, and I sent Ian a link before, I don't know whether you had a chance to read it, he says that you were playing a 12-string guitar on stage, and Bob Dylan was sitting at your feet.
Please. Where did you get that from?
That's what Bill Harry said.
He said that about me?
Yeah.
I was playing the 12-string. I mean, I do play guitar, but only three chords. But I never
played... It's a good story, though, isn't it, mate?
It is actually good, yeah. But I've never played guitar on stage with a rival. I used to with the XLs, but never with the rival. Bob Dylan sitting at my feet?
Yeah.
My God.
Yes, go on.
He was obviously tripping out on something.
Oh, you.
Yeah. That's a new one on me, actually. Bob Dylan sitting at my feet, yeah.
So what was your career like? Were you kind of, you know, were you expected to, you know, get number one in the States and all that? Did the record, how were the record company with you?
I guess we were just trusting our management on that to promote it in the States and whatever. So it's all a bit vague, to be quite honest with me, back then. That year, we did a lot of TV shows, and we ended up doing the Royal Gala, and I met the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. I was, you know, the representative from the band singled out. And then we did, like, Maynard Ferguson show. Do you remember him? Jazz player.
Was that in the UK or USA?
I think he was American, but he'd started his career over in England, I think. Anyway, we did, like, the Morecambe & Wise programme on telly. Dudley, you know, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. So we did an awful lot of telly for about a year. And we were being guided into, like, sort of middle-of-the-road pop-type stuff, which we didn't really want to do. Our heart was still in, like, Motown and soul and funk music. Anyway, there was a conflict of, you know, of opinions and direction with our manager. And I must say, Tony Hawley passed on a few years ago as well, but he was a great manager in as much as that he got us where we got to. But he saw us going in a direction that we did not want to go in, right? We probably could have stuck with it and maybe made, like, you know, pop records for the rest of our career. But when you're an artist, the danger is if you get locked into something you don't want to do and you're successful at it, you're trapped. That's what you've got to do for the rest of your career. And I could sense this at the time. So I thought, we don't want it. We don't want this. So... cut a long story short, we parted company with our original manager, Tony Hall, who I have the utmost respect for, you know, I must say. It just wasn't working out. Then we got signed up to CBS because we were originally with Decca. Did a deal with CBS for Arrival, made a couple of albums with them, and then that all kind of went pear-shaped. They didn't quite know how to market us, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera. We became very disillusioned with the whole thing. So that kind of petered out where we ended our contract with CBS. And then Tony O'Malley, who was the keyboard player with Arrival, he knew some really good musicians, some good bass players, guitarists and whatever. And he got them together, and me, Paddy and Diane. Carol, the other singer, had left. So then we formed Kokomo, doing the kind of music we like. Funky, soul-y, gospel-y type stuff. Basically, that's how our career went.
And did you get a deal with Kokomo?
Yeah, with CBS again, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Arrival fizzled out, and then we morphed into Kokomo, yeah. We got a good deal with CBS.
Okay.
But once again, they didn't really know how to market us.
Now you've done two different bands.
Yeah.
Two different deals, and they still don't know who they really are.
Well, CBS, they're a huge company. Basically, how can I put it? Procure other big artists from other record labels. So they usually procure people who are already established. So they don't have to do that much work to promote them. When you're not that well known, like we were that well known, they didn't really have a didn't have much imagination how to package us, market us or whatever, because we were a white band doing basically black style music. And back then people were a bit more purist. They, you know, if you were white and doing black music, oh no, you can't do that, you can't do that. Whereas now those limitations aren't there in today's music. I think it's far more healthier now that you can do anything, really. You don't, you know, you can't, like blue-eyed, you know, we call blue-eyed soul band and all this, that and the other. So, yeah, so they didn't know how to market us. So we floundered, basically. We were in the studio recording.
I have a lot of sympathy. I went through exactly the same thing with Polygram. Just in the sense that no direction and they don't know what to do. You know what you're doing. Yeah, you know exactly what you're doing. Yeah. But they don't get on board with that, or at least one aspect of it doesn't get on board. And you just get caught up
in that, the machine.
In the whole world. Yeah. When you're trying to do a very straightforward representation of what it is you are and you want to do, you're not allowed to do it. And it's awfully frustrating, isn't it?
It was. I mean, we were like the hottest ticket in town back then. All the big managers were coming down to check us out. And we ended up signing with Pink Floyd's manager, a guy called Steve O'Rourke, and he loved us. He just waved the money in our faces and we just followed, you know. How shallow were we?
Oh, we're all the same.
But also Miles Copeland was hugely interested in us, and he had the police. We had a few meetings with him, and he went around and he showed us these gig sheets of the bands he was managing. And they had like half a day off a year. That did not appeal to me. Anyway, as I say, Steve O'Rourke came along, loved the band, so we signed with him. And I think he renegotiated the deal with CBS. He managed Pink Floyd, so Pink Floyd was his baby.
Yeah.
Now, the story goes, Steve ended up dropping Kokomo. And I have to say, there were a lot of drugs involved in the band at the time.
Right.
And he'd always said to us, if I hear about any sort of A-class drugs going on, he said, I don't want to know.
What sort of drugs are you talking about?
Smack.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it had gotten dysfunctional then?
Yeah, basically. Right. For some reason, we could still go on stage and kill it. I mean, I wasn't involved, I have to say that.
Yeah.
I dabbled here and there with different things, but never something that heavy, you know?
No.
Anyway, Steve O'Rourke called us into the office one day. He said, I don't want to manage you anymore. And we're like, what? But half the band was so stoned, it didn't sort of register with them anyway. I just remember walking out of his office in a daze. What do we do now? Anyway, eventually, we were trying to make head or tail of why he dropped us. And I thought, maybe it's because of the drugs, blah, blah, blah. But through time, we found out eventually that Pink Floyd were jealous of Steve's passion for our band, and we were getting all the love and attention from Steve, and they felt like they were being neglected. So they gave Steve an ultimatum saying it's either us or them. They were his big act. We had to go.
It wouldn't be the first time that had happened, would it?
No, probably not.
You know, with bands getting jealous of each other.
As they say in Liverpool, jealousy will creep in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm involved in the modern day Liverpool music scene, and it's exactly the same.
There's always petty jealousies, you know.
Oh, they're always slagging each other.
You can't believe it. You think, like, everyone, like, we're adults, you know, deal with it. And, you know, Pink Floyd were so well established, we were no threat to them anyway. But they obviously didn't like the fact that Steve loved us. He really loved us as people as well.
So what did you do then when Kokomo's fallen apart with the drums?
Oh, I think we sort of went from tin pop manager to tin pop manager. We ended up basically just managing ourselves in the end.
Right.
And drugs were still prevalent within the band, you know. Eventually people did clean up and we lost one member, our bass player, to an overdose. But anyway, we just sort of carried on. We were still being asked to do gigs. And
making a living out of it at this moment.
Not really, no.
Did you have to take another job or anything like that?
Well, I had to sign on, didn't I?
Yeah.
I had to sign on, you know, get benefits and all that. And at one point, I did a bit of house cleaning, you know, which I'm good at, actually. You want your houses clean.
You'll never go hungry, Frank. You can always clean houses.
Well, you do what you got to do, you know.
Yeah, you do.
Now, we do selective gigs with as many original members of Kokomo as we can. Yeah, and the audiences still love us.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Is this a good time to play Stuck in a Groove, Frank?
You can. It's not one of my favourites, but go on.
Well, I've got Stuck in the Groove, yeah. And I've got A Little Bit Further Away.
Oh, there's a big story to that.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. We'll play A Little Bit Further Away. Soul, I think, Frank, isn't it?
Yeah, do you think so? Yeah,
that's a soul.
Yeah,
and that's one of yours.
Yeah, I wrote that one. Yeah,
I was looking you when I was doing a bit of research of this, and one journalist had described you as a pub rock band. And I think that's probably because you did the tour, didn't you? You did the Naughty Rhythms tour with Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Lily and the Red Hot Peppers. But I wouldn't have classed you as a pub band or a pub rock band, would you?
No, I think we were sort of miscast. I don't know how that happened. We used to do a place called the Hope and Anchor, which was in Islington in London. And that was like a pub club type of thing. So they were our first gigs, really. So we probably got branded just because we played those venues.
That was a big part of the punk scene, wasn't it, the Hope and Anchor?
I think it was, yeah, eventually. Yeah. It was one of those real sweaty gigs, you know. Yeah, I mean, we had great, great gigs there.
The Stranglers were based there, weren't they, for a while, weren't they?
Yeah, the Stranglers came out.
Probably. I don't know much about all those bands, to be quite honest.
In addition to Kokomo and Arrival and all that, you've worked with some major people, haven't you? When I was telling you about that story that Bill Harry had written about, I thought that must have been where Dylan saw you when you were allegedly playing the 12-string guitar with Dylan at your feet. It didn't happen, but we won't ruin that. But you were asked to play on the Desire album. Can you talk us through that? What was that like, getting a call from him or, I guess, his people? I'm sure he didn't ring you up at home.
Well, we were touring the States at the time, and we were playing, I think, a place called The Bottom Line in New York with the, do you remember the Chambers Brothers at all? They were the headliners. We were supporting them. Anyway, we were just doing gigs around New York. Next, you know, Steve O'Rourke, our manager, he said, oh, I've got you a session with Bob Dylan. And it was like this Renaissance period. He'd been out of the picture for quite a while. So it was big news. So we ended up in the studio and he records sort of live. It was a media circus, basically. In the control room, you couldn't move because of the media, because he was sort of coming up, you know, coming back into the business again. And it was all of Kokomo were there. Eric Clapton was there. It was just crazy.
What songs were you doing? Can you remember?
I can't remember. It's the one called Hurricane, is that it?
Yeah. Very famous song. The album was called Desire.
Yeah.
And he had a fiddle player.
There was a fiddle player. I mean, it was just craziness, it really was. Yeah. And the funny thing was, me, Paddy and Diane, the vocalists, we were doing these background parts. And Bob Dylan was sort of in the corner of the studio, quite sort of secluded from everybody else. And the producer kept coming out of the control room. He says, I want more vibrato. Give us more vibrato, you know. So I'm like, trying to do all this thing. And then Bob comes over to us and he says, I don't want your voices wobbling up and down. And we said, what? He said, I don't like the way your voices are wobbling. And I said to Paddy and Di, I said, I think he means vibrato. So anyway, we tried to, you know, cut the vibrato down. Then we'd do another take, and then the producer would come out again. No, I need more vibrato, more vibrato. I said, well, try telling that to Bob. I said, because he doesn't want it. He said, well, I'm the producer, and blah, blah, and all this. So anyway, I just found that quite amusing that Bob Dylan didn't know the term vibrato.
I once did a gig with Mick Jones at The Clash, and I had to teach him the chords to a song, and he didn't know the names of chords.
Yeah, he's like me, because I play keyboards as well.
You know, considering the magnificent music he's given us. So did you have any other interactions with Bob?
No.
That was it?
That was it, really. He just seemed very remote.
Right, okay.
You know,
according to some of the notes I've read about Desire, the band, your band, are on the track Romance in Durango. On Desire. and this is a track I'd love to hear, Ian, because you know the song Hurricane, which is a Dylan classic, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm only guessing. I can't remember. I can't remember the song at all.
Well, the notes that I read this morning said that there was a disco funk version with Kokomo and Dylan on the Hurricane track, but it hasn't been released.
Okay.
But let me play a little bit of Romance in Durango.
Okay.
And apparently Kokomo are on that, although they're not given the credit on the album.
Hot chili peppers in the blistering sun. Dust
At night I dream of bells in the village steeple. Then I see the bloody face of the Lord. Was it me that shot him down in the cantina? Was it my hand that held the gun?
Ring any bells?
Not at all. And the harmony line that I just heard, that didn't sound like us.
Yeah. No.
That sounded like him overdubbed on himself to me.
I think the main instrumentation he was using on that whole record was Scarlett Rivera, who's the violinist, and she was the main personality on that album.
Oh, was she? Okay.
Yeah, really well known for that.
What's her name?
Scarlett Rivera. I think her real name was Donna Shea. I don't think she played on. She played on a couple of other things that he did, but he found her for that Desire album. And then she kind of disappeared. I think.
She was on that tour that they filmed because showed that. God, she was fantastic, wasn't she?
Went in it herself. I don't think he told her what to do.
Yeah,
just did her own thing and stamped all over it, and it was fabulous. You know.
Well, he didn't seem to know what he was doing anyway in the studio.
Maybe he'd had some of the lads smack.
But what was it like working with Brian Ferry?
It was great, actually. Brian's a lovely guy, great to work with. And he was with his manager at the time. It was 1977. And his manager at the time was Mark Fenwick. And have you heard of Fenwick's of Bond Street?
No.
You haven't? No, it's a big posh place anyway. And apparently they were his parents or grandparents. But everything was very professional. Even for rehearsal, I would have a stretch limo come and pick me up at my door in Richmond and take me to rehearsal and bring me back. So everything was that, you know, such high style. And just everything was just so well organised. And he was, you know, he was great to work with, Brian. The only problem we had was that everything was very, very loud on stage. So sometimes you'd come off and your ears would be ringing afterwards, you know. But yeah, I enjoyed working with Brian.
You've also toured with Tom Robinson Band, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't the Tom Robinson Band who, you know, originally had the hits. It was just another band that he formulated. Yeah, I did a couple of tours with him, yeah. And they were good. Yeah, he wrote some really good stuff, Tom.
Some great songs, Tom Robinson. Yeah. Power in the Darkness.
Yeah. I never was keen on 2468. I never got into that one. But War Baby and things like that. Yeah. You know, really good songs.
So you were doing backing vocals, were you?
Only on tour, not on the record. As I said to me, a lot of the artists I worked with was just touring more than actually recording on their material.
And would you play guitar as well or just do backing vocals?
Just PVs, yeah, backing vocals, yeah. I mean, me, Diane Paddy, we did a lot of, around about the time when Kokomo were popular, we did a lot of sessions. But for lesser known artists, they sort of came and went, and I can't even remember some of their names. But we did a lot of session work at that time, but nothing with big major artists.
So you say your forte then has been singing down the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, we started off as a vocal band, you know.
Harmonising, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I do with Kokomo. I sing with two other girls. It used to be me, Paddy and Diane. And as I say, Diane passed away a few years ago. Paddy now lives in France, so it's difficult for him to coming over. So there's two other girls now that we do the three-part harmonies with Kokomo. And our lead singer is Tony, who's got this sort of like Joe Cocker-type voice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we do quite a few covers, some of our own stuff. But it's funky, which we like.
Do you, in a sense, do you enjoy it now more than then because, you know, there's less pressure? Or did you still enjoy those years in the 70s with Arrival and Kokomo and working with all these people you've spoken about?
Well, when I look back, you know, I enjoyed Kokomo more than anything because we were doing the stuff we really liked. I enjoyed certain aspects of Arrival. I loved the XLs because we'd only just started out and we were just doing all the Motown stuff that we loved. So, yeah, when we gig now, yeah, I really enjoy it.
What year did you leave Liverpool to go and live in London?
68.
Oh, that's really early, isn't it, then?
Yeah, 1968, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you ever come back?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, the last time I was up there, I contacted the house that we used to... The person who lived in the house in Kirby, where I used to live.
Right.
Which is where the XL was started. And I contacted the person who lived there and she invited me to come, you know, to come and see the house again. And it was very emotional, actually.
Was it?
Yeah, oh. She invited me in. I saw the parlour where we used to rehearse. We used to call it the parlour, which they now call the front room or whatever.
Yeah.
So I come back because obviously I've got family still in Liverpool. So I come back. And, you know, it's great. And I'm so happy that Liverpool has prospered so much since when it was the City of Culture.
Yeah, that was the kind of the turning point.
Yeah. Obviously, a lot of money was ploughed in then, you know. And it's good to see Liverpool come up. The people haven't changed. They're still as rough as ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gets me. You see these gorgeous-looking women and handsome men, but especially the women, like, you know, cheekbones to die for and, you know, impeccable style. until they open their mouths. All these four-letter words keep coming out. Oh, amen, you know. But I love all that. To me, Liverpool is such a unique place.
Yeah, it is.
In all my travels, I've travelled a lot, doing tours and whatever. There's nowhere like Liverpool. The humour, and we take no shit in Liverpool.
It's not about the women. They just look you in the eye and tell you.
Oh, God, yeah. If you try to get above your station, your legs will be cut down from underneath you, but quick. And I love that because it keeps you so grounded.
Right, Frank, you're still writing material, and you sent us this track now, which hasn't been released as such, but it's called Swan Song. What's that about?
Yeah, it's a project I started before COVID and before Diane Birch, who I mentioned, passed away a couple of years ago. It was just an idea, just a project for me, Paddy and Diane, because we were the singers with Kokomo, just to do a few songs, make a CD, and then just flog it at Kokomo gigs, because we've still got diehard fans who'll just buy anything we do, So we just did some home recordings, and it's Swan Song. It's just the idea like that, sort of at the end of our career, we don't know what's going to happen, but we're still here. And that's what we're saying in the song. And it's just covering the fact that, the three of us are lifelong friends. We took a ride on angel's wings, which is one of the lyrics, and all that business, So it's basically summing up where we are now, even though, sadly Diane's passed away. But it's Diane's on the vocal backgrounds on this one. The lead singer is Paddy, and he's mainly singing in like a sort of more like a falsetto voice. But Paddy's voice seemed to suit the song the best, so he did it. And yeah, it's just a project that I'm still carrying on with. I've written about 10 or 12 songs, just recorded here at home. My home studio. So not actually state-of-the-art recordings, but they sound okay to me.
We know each other inside out. We've known each other and bad, the hopes we've shared, the dreams we had.
We took a ride on angels' wings. Still we fly, still we sing. Forever sweet, forever strong, as we sing.
Still going strong.
So that'll be coming out in an album, will it, Frank?
Hopefully, yeah. It's sort of dragged on and dragged on because of COVID and whatever.
Yeah.
So that's why it's taken so long. I am now waiting for Paddy to come back from France just to finish some of the songs off and then kind of ready to go, yeah. But yeah, just no big potatoes, just going to do it on CD or however we can stream it or whatever. I don't quite know. I'm not up to speed with how you know, get things out there these days. But I've got some friends who can help me with that.
But you're still creating the music. You've been in the business for, you know, if you don't mind me saying, a long time, and you're still creating. You're still, well, more than 50 years, isn't it?
Is that? Oh, my God. I've never done the sums. Yeah. I started when I was 18 anyway, and I'm 77 now.
Good on it, mate.
Thank you, yes. It's all smoke and mirrors, darling. I put a bit of makeup on.
It's been really interesting. What a varied career you've had, and working with so many different people, and you're still producing stuff.
It's who you are, Mick, in the end. I don't want to sound precious or whatever, but it's just in you. It doesn't go. Your passion, your love for music or whatever, it's never changed with me. I still want to be writing music. I still want to be involved in music. Yeah, it's my thing. Yeah.
All right, Frank, good to see you, mate. And if you come up, give us a shout.
Well,
nice one, Frank.
Okay, thank you.
See you, mate. Bye.